So it's a bit awkward, besides the fact I'm not used to talking Wednesdays. Mitzad echad, some people are leaving. I want to say goodbye in the proper farewell. Mitzad those who are staying, don't give them the feeling that they expect people to leave at the time. So just say that it's awkward, and I'll do it anyways. The year in yeshiva is supposed to be, on the one hand, a year which is an extremely important year. In other words, you should look back later on in life and view this as a watershed year, as a time in which you grew and developed. However, the much more important, much more basic thing is to take this not as a highlight, but to take this basically as a platform in which to develop or to continue developing and to continue moving forward in life. At the end of the day, the yeshiva's institution, and what's much more important, each individual, will not be measured by what you do next year, but rather what you do the next 50 years. Not what you do, not how many hours you learn next year alone, but how many hours you learn over the course of your lifetime. How you educate your children. How much chesed will you do not only when you're 21, but when you're 41. Or 61, how we develop a chaver will be down the road. In other words, it's sedala derech. In other words, it's a year in which, or it's a time in which you can come and accumulate and gather a lot in one instance. But eventually, it's if you treat this as capital in the bank, just to eat and to eventually consume it, you have this amount of knowledge, this amount of time you've studied, and now over time you exhaust it because you don't generate new capital. So then basically, sooner or later, the effect of the year will wear off, and it will not be long-lasting. On the other hand, if you take this, the way you should, as an opportunity to get to acquire tools, skills, and especially commitment to further the same goals for the rest of a lifetime, to learn next year and next year. In other words, that even though you may be learning next year less or more, but that you're able to have the tools to continue and to be kovetim and to you're developing. If you think about it, you have many, 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 many more hours, much more than this year, way in the future. And this depends to a large degree how a person treats the year. Am Yisrael, Mamad Har Sinai, the real problem there was they felt it was too intense. They were losing their patience with the time in Har Sinai. They were there for about 10 months or whatever. And, just about 10, 11 months. And eventually, it began to wear upon them. They began to feel they were too much time in Mamad Har Sinai. It was too intense. Under the shadow of the Shekhinah. Constant... I'm at Aron Brit Hashem in the middle of the Machaneh. I'm at Misaviv the Mishkan Ohel Moed Yachanu, and they develop spiritual fatigue. And if you ask of why, presumably they didn't feel engaged enough. They felt there was too much pressure. They felt they were losing their autonomy. And now, if you ask of why. Apparently they weren't ready. They weren't ready enough. They just left Egypt. They had spent so many years as slaves in Egypt. They were seeking relaxation. There was too much tension, historical and then metaphysical tension, which didn't allow them to absorb it properly. They wanted relaxation. Chazal has some very strong and condemning statements about Dor HaMidbar, for instance. Ham bochel mishpachotav, al yiskei mishpachotav. that they were upset that Mamad Arsinai, because Baruch Hu asked the arayos to them. And of course, the whole picture of Sefer Bamidbar, in a sense, deals with the problem of pleasure, hedonism. Kivrata Ta'ava, Miraglim, and Korach, it begins Kivrata Ta'ava, all they remember from Egypt, from the years of struggle and of suffering. Let's not forget, in Egypt, hundreds of thousands of people were murdered. There was genocide going on. They were taking babies and drowning them by the thousands. People being killed and persecuted under the pyramids by the tens of thousands. And all they sit back and reminisce is about Avatichim and Kishuim and Shumim and Bitzalim. So obviously it's deluded. But think of what... See what it says to you about their mindset in the Midbar. It's like they'll have like people will be sitting back and trying to reminisce about the good life in Eastern Europe right before in the ghetto. That's what's going on in the Midbar. They're reminiscing about the great life in Egypt. We all know what was going on in Egypt in terms of the suffering and the persecution. From there it continues to the Miraglim, who want to stay in the desert or to return to Egypt with no national aspirations, with no trust in Kodesh Baruch Hu, and it eventually gets to Dustin Baviram. And all they want is Nachlat Sadeh V'Kerem. Lo Eretz Zavat Chavu Dvash Aviyoteinu Latek Lanu Nachlat Sadeh V'Kerem. All Dustin Baviram want is one simple thing. All they want is the good life, meaning nachlat sadeh vakerem, and therefore it's no surprise, or there's nothing to be surprised about when they take Mamad Har Sinai and they escape as fast as possible and as far as possible. And so the reason is they're apparently unprepared, unready, and rather than looking back at Mamad Har Sinai as a period of building and development, and a period in which they were able to take Kedusha and Ruach HaKodesh and Torah, then use this as they journey to Eretz Israel, as they journey to build a life within history and within historical activity, they see as something to be discarded and to be an experience that you have to run away from. With such a mindset, obviously, the rest of Amidbar is a tragedy. Of course, the lesson is quite obvious. First, it sets priorities straight. To recognize that Avatichim and Kishuim and Betzalim and all this stuff, pleasure eventually... Eventually, pleasure exhausts itself. A person who chases pleasure, sooner or later, the pleasure itself becomes too used to it, becomes uniform, becomes routine. So it's chasing greater pleasure, and the more he chases, of course, the more it eludes him, because the less ability he has to achieve greater pleasure. And of course, it's an unending cycle in which, at the end of the day, it's frustration, and there's only frustration, nothing else left, and a sense of emptiness and void after. And yet, if a person does something, even though it's more difficult, it's more, requires more emotional and spiritual effort, but he feels a sense of accomplishment and achievement, which accompanies him throughout life later on. And this is basically a challenge now. You can go back and relax a bit. It was a quite intense year. It was a year which was intense, which was long hours, in which basic questions of human life were raised. And now you just basically shut down the switch and, like in Israel, relax. Or the Havdil, you can take this and before make this stepping stone to building foundation, building much more significant and much greater achievement later on. And of course there's much work to be done in the future, from finishing your continuing Torah education, continuing your general education, integrating the two into a unified whole, raising a family, and all this is contingent upon a sense of commitment and energy and excitement, which should be there. Now, I say a word or two about, if you want, about Torah Madam, modern Orthodoxy. Somewhat similar to what I spoke on Chalashudas, but I'll do it in from an American perspective and in a different language as well. Essentially, modern Orthodoxy, like any system which tries to combine two things, is attempting to combine things which create a clash in attention. And of course, a person, and there's almost, if you want, conflicting perspectives which are inherent in the enterprise. One, general knowledge, and general knowledge basically assumes knowledge, which at its essence is human, based on human observation, based upon an empirical approach to life and to the world. Its perspective is human achievement, that we can shoot for the stars, we can do whatever we want, we can achieve. And modern man, to a large degree, is characterized by his willingness to run forward and to try, if you want, to exceed his limitations, and with great accomplishments, from flight to space, from any flight, if you think about it, and I mentioned this in the issue a few other occasions, if you think every time you fly on an airplane, and people sit there and kvetch whether they got enough ice in their soda or not, or whether they got the right drink, or whether their legroom is too much or too little, and all you can think is, you're sitting in an airplane, which anybody who lived prior to the 20th century would have not believed that it's possible for a human being to arrive at such an achievement. It's literally man being able to overcome nature. It's man being able, it's Gadlus HaAdam in the sense of technology. You know, everything the Rev writes about in Lonely Man of Faith in the first few pages, about the greatness of man. And it's unparalleled achievement to be able to be suspended in midair and to fly from here to there. And all people do is think about, as I said before, about the soda, about the line to the bathroom. And rather than for 30 seconds contemplating what this means in terms of human achievement, in terms of human destiny, and some of the bigger pictures, which are not necessarily... not necessarily maybe in the newspaper ad, but what does this mean? And the same is true of medicine. Every time you go into a hospital, what does it mean about man's ability to conquer disease up to a certain degree? And the same is true every time you get stuck in a traffic jam and so on and so forth. There has to be some sort of a perspective which is beyond the here and the now. Now, this perspective, the one he's ennobling, is convincing. On the other hand, it's all from the point of view of the human being. It's all from the human perspective, the tremendous confidence in man, his abilities, accomplishments, but side by side with that, it's also only the human perspective. And you have to put next to that the other half, which is not the human perspective, but the Kadosh Baruch Hu's element. In other words, this the second half of the equation, which is basically man is totally dependent, how everything, his knowledge is revealed, is not his own, but it's revealed from above. His existence is dependent upon the Kadosh Baruch Hu, which Rambam formulates in the beginning of Mishneh Torah, that his whole existence is a function of the fact that Kadosh Baruch Hu exists and provides him with existence, and so on and so forth. And in a different sense, his modern Orthodoxy has within an inherent clash. It's dueling perspectives. And trying to handle this dual perspective can create one or two things. Or, let me say this, it can create confusion and perplexion, or the Rambam's language, Moren Nevuchim, you can be perplexed and navoch and confused. You can be, on the other hand, ennobled. In other words, it can be a creative tension, which doesn't mean it's easily resolved, doesn't mean there's one right answer, or there's one exact formulation, but broadly speaking, the need to absorb and integrate and synthesize two conflicting perspectives, even though it's difficult, it creates a much deeper and richer experience. And you have to come and somehow combine the two and figure out where is man coming to, where is man going to, with and they're taking into account the fact that he, on the one hand, is such a great being, on the other hand, such a petty, small being. And when taking into account that the world can be understood in natural, from a natural perspective on the one hand, and from a religious perspective on the other hand, how do you combine all this? It creates tension, but tension can be extremely creative and ennobling fact, and not only a confusing one. And so the tension is built into modern orthodoxy. That's the source of its greatest achievements, because by at its best, it indeed combines the two. And if you read, for instance, take Bikashta Misham, take the treatment there of nature in Bikashta Misham, compare it to Umram Bitachon and Chazonish, see the difference in the treatments. See the difference. Someone's been exposed to philosophy of nature and philosophy of science, and someone who's not been exposed. See how it's treated differently, how the perspective is different. And in that regard, modern orthodoxy has a lot to offer. And look at the accomplishment of, if you go back to the Middle Ages, of the Rambam, and if you want Spain in general, relative to Ashkenaz. On the other hand, it's also the source not only of its great accomplishments, but also of its failures. Because it's easy, as I said before, to become confused, perplexed, it indeed creates a sort of a conflict or a challenge to which a person has to apply himself. This is in the philosophical level. However, on the practical level, there's something else, which is modern orthodoxy itself is not only a philosophical movement, it's also somewhat of an historical movement. Meaning, when the world underwent the process of modernization, the Industrial Revolution, secularization, which accompanied this, and so essentially orthodoxy was faced with a choice. The choice was to, and when this world was seen as hostile, antagonistic to religion, so orthodoxy had to do one of two things. It had to do either to reject modernity, because the modern world was secular, anti-religious, and the like, or it could accept modernity and find a way to be able to be both modern and orthodox. Now, the first way worked to a certain degree, but for a larger number of people, it wasn't an option. I'm just talking now historically, not whether they're right or wrong. Lemaisa, for many people, it was clear they would be modern. The question was, would they be modern and orthodox, or modern and not orthodox? And when essentially, if they were given only a choice of be either orthodox or modern, many of them, it was clear what they would have chosen. Think of modern orthodoxy basically arose not only as a philosophical movement to combine the best of both worlds, to try to somehow take the ochel and leave the psolet out of the modern world and to create a more sophisticated, developed, and deeper religious outlook, but also simply to provide the ability for people not to choose either or, because the consequences of such a choice would have been extremely tragic. And therefore, modern orthodoxy became also a historical movement, providing a safety net for people who want to be more modern and can be orthodox as well. To a large degree, modern orthodoxy therefore exists really side by side. you have on the one hand a movement which is philosophical, which is trying to engage the best of both worlds to create a more nobling experience religiously. On the other hand, simply it's about a safety net for people who find the difficulty in being orthodox and not modern. Now, the upshot of all this is that a person can become modern orthodox because he's extremely committed and he really has a desire to combine the best of both worlds, and with all the difficulties that this creates, and the investment that's required of him in terms of time, in terms of energy, and the like, and side by side, there can be people in the same shul who are modern orthodox for other reasons. And that's how people always articulate this. I'm saying if you analyze what's going on from above, this is the underlying rationale. But differently, you can be modern orthodox from a position of strength or weakness. Position of strength, if you want to arrive, as I said before, at the synthesis, you know, along the lines of of the Rambam and the Rav and things my father has written and the like, or the Havdil, it could be simply from a position of weakness, that better to be orthodox and modern than the instead of Hesder. You can go to Hesder because you want to combine Torah and participation in the historical process and a willingness to for self-sacrifice with everybody else that's sharing the burden. Or you can go to Hesder because otherwise I'll go 3 years in the army. I will not retain my my religious level the way it should be. I remember quite clearly, I joined the army Bismano, and a friend of the from another yeshiva to the right of us, he said to me, I went to Hesder, and he shared that tea. And it's very not ennobling, but at the end of the day, he achieved his goal. His son registered next year. And if he got 3 years, I suspect that wouldn't have happened. So there's a dual dynamic. And that's why on the one hand you have phenomena like the Rav, on the other hand you have a sense that often it's lukewarm and pyrive and if not worse. The challenge is, after a year in yeshiva, after 2 years in yeshiva, after 5 years in yeshiva, the challenge is to come and to continue from a perspective of strength, to believe that your derech is not one of compromise and weakness, and that you never, what can you do? You only have you have no other choice. But rather to believe this indeed may be more difficult, but it's also deeper, will provide you with greater depth, with the ability to understand the world better. Because at the end of the day, the Kodesh Baruch Hu created a multifaceted universe. And the universe is such that sends out conflicting signals. And that, what you see, that both perspectives are true. Each one is rooted in reality. And by trying to collect more than one perspective, you're in a sense identifying things which exist in the world. And if you come with such a perspective, you will be able to have a sense of self-confidence and of purpose and of mission. Now, it's contingent upon one thing, or if you want, what's the litmus test? That it's done with a deep commitment to Torah itself. Meaning the person is serious about his learning, he's serious about his self-discipline, serious about everything else he does. The more serious you are, the more you prove that you're in a position of strength. And the more lukewarm you are, the more pyrive you are, the more the less serious you are, obviously it's proving that it's a position of weakness. And this is the challenge. The challenge is not only personally. I'm convinced everyone in this room will go from a position of strength and continue to develop. But it's also within the community of being willing to engage, being willing to volunteer, being willing to participate, to have input, as in Shabbat, the best, most important input is in Chinuch. You have the most direct influence, you change lives. You can simply impact upon lives, especially ages in which people are willing to be influenced, people are open to changing the course of their lives. You can have tremendous impact. I guarantee anybody going to Chinuch, I guarantee he'll be frustrated. I also guarantee that he'll have tremendous nachat. Presuming that he's willing to recognize that's a process, that his first month will not necessarily be a wonder, but if he's willing to have the patience to get to learn the tricks of the trade and to essentially basically have the patience with people, and he's willing to love his students, he'll have tremendous nachat. There'll be life after life, he'll impact upon and change. He'll be able to look back and say, so and so, I was able to help him, I was able to impact upon him, and the like. That is the most direct and obvious avenue of influence. However, there are many, many avenues to do this. Obviously, within the educational system, I haven't checked recently, but as a few years ago, there was a huge shortage of mechanchim, especially outside New York. I'd say New York includes the rest of the world. I don't mean only Arizona. I mean the whole Jewish world. There is a tremendous shortage, and people are needed, especially good people, especially people who can interact with the communities. They come through their experiences. Usually, also because supply and demand. A person can make a respectable career in terms of parnasa, and when it's all said and done, there are opportunities. It's a question of picking them up and using them. We had a few weeks ago in New York a conference of mechanchim and rabbanim who are alumni of the yeshiva. It wasn't only a pleasure to see the people doing work, but the sense of how they've grown the job, of how they're dealing with very basic issues. With maturity, with insight, with responsibility, and I have to tell you that being the rabbi in your education requires a lot of handling many tricky situations. There are pressures, conflicting pressures from so many different sources, and to say nothing about kids of Balabatim who are willing to cooperate and those who are not willing to cooperate. What's impressive is how people grow in the job, how they really have an understanding of the dynamics of life, and of human nature, and etc. However, person be active in the community, in good chassadim, in giving a share in the shul, in being active in the shul in terms of how the shul is in terms of seriousness, in terms of shiurim, in terms of many, many other things. There are many, many avenues and ways to be engaged and involved. And at the end of the day, if a person is leaving after a year, so next year, wherever you are in the community you're in, be the academic community, be it your home community, be involved, be active. And down life, of course, to do the same, to remain involved and engaged. Don't forget, Kadosh Baruch Hu, in the day, Kadosh Baruch Hu's main, or one of his main attributes is giving. He doesn't owe us anything. He gives us content, Zanat HaKol, Mechaye HaMetim, and so on and so forth. And we have to do the same thing. You choose a profession, think how you have the opportunities for giving. Forgiving to the community, forgiving to others, for returning to society. Take all this into consideration and the like. In other words, to summarize, I'll return to what I said in the beginning. It's not a year to say, I had great experience, like in a year in Europe, I had great experience, and to Dr. Cherish, you know, as an experience, it's a year, it's a challenge, which is we'd like to challenge you to continue to develop. If you study one or two masechtot this year, you're 50 years, you can do many, many, many more masechtot. I'll just give a simple. I have a shiur balabatim once a week. We study Iyun, high level Iyun. I hope it's high level, but at any rate, yeshiva level Iyun, we'll call it. Once a week, so let's say we average about 25 daf a year. 10 years, it's 250 daf iyun. 250 daf iyun really are worth, but here's a few more hundred because every daf of the year you expand to a few other sugyot. So if, just you come once a week, you stay, you learn at the same pace, you can end up doing 25 daf iyun 10 years, 25 daf iyun, which is much more probably you did here in one year. Multiply that by more than 10 years or by more than one shir, and you're on your way to being a serious Talmid Chacham, and the same is true of Gmut Chassadim and many other things as well. So, Mizrat Hashem, Techu Michayil El Chayil, and really view this as a springboard to continue growing, and Kuvei Hashem Echlifu Koach, Yalu Ever Kanisharim, Yalchu Velo Yafu, Yarutsu Velo Yigau, and Mizrat Hashem, all those coming back or staying, and of course, same holds true, and we'll be glad to see them back, and Mizrat Hashem, if not, we'll see everyone back at some point, Mizrat Hashem, and Tudar Rabbah, I think it was, I'll just conclude by saying, I think it was a very good year in terms of the learning dynamics, the seriousness, and the social dynamics. Nothing's ever perfect, and we can always say something would have been better, something would have been different, but brought from the perspective, you know, the big picture, and relative to many other pictures, you know, Baruch Hashem, it was a very good year. It was enjoyable to teach, it was enjoyable to read the Beit Midrash, to the sense of common purpose, of seriousness, and Shabbat Hashem, we should continue with the same sense of purpose here in Chutz Laaretz, and Shabbat Hashem, everyone back there to Israel sooner or later. Tzadar Rabbah.
Someone to call you, Maria.